You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Troll. You're listening to WPS1 Art Radio, WPS1 Contemporary Art Center, among affiliate at www.wps1.org. You might also be listening to frankprattle.com. Let's hope so. Today we are located on the corner of Clement, and I'm not quite positive the other street.
Euclid.
Is it Euclid?
Yeah.
In the lovely Sunset neighborhood of San Francisco, outside in a cafe. And I have an extra special guest with me today, Alex Donis, who's a visual artist from Los Angeles. Hi, Alex.
Hello, how are you?
I'm absolutely lovely. Maybe just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Yeah, I'm a Los Angeles-based artist. I've been working for a number of years in everything from video to installation. I've probably for the last 5 years have been focusing a lot on painting. But, you know, when you think and discuss in terms of media, it's anything really that might come up from photography to printmaking. I really don't like to narrow myself down to one particular media.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the shows that you currently have up is a show on criminal justice at
Yes.
the San Francisco State University's Gallery of Fine Arts.
Uh-huh.
Tell us a little bit about that work. I think the title of it is called War.
Yeah, it's a body of work from 2001. I'm really excited that I'm part of this exhibit, mainly because I have an interesting history and connection to San Francisco, and to come back with this body of work is pretty exciting for me. War was first shown at the Watts Towers Art Center in Los Angeles. And Watts, for you may not know, it's a pretty tough neighborhood in Los Angeles. It's kind of been known mainly as an African-American quote-unquote ghetto, and although now there are a lot of Latinos in Watts. And a number of years ago, back in 94 through 99, I taught there. I taught drawing and painting to a lot of kids. And they have this beautiful gallery in their art center. And I'd always thought, wow, it'd be wonderful to do an exhibit at this space. And it just so happened, in 2001, the director approached me. His name is Mark Greenfield, and he approached me to do an exhibition at the Towers and to coincide with the reopening of the Towers, because the Towers themselves are these phenomenal, like, outsider art, gigantic, pillars that represent, Marco Polo's kind of journey, and Simon Rodia, this Italian outsider artist in the 20s, built these in his backyard. And in, I think, the 94 earthquake or so in Northridge, they got damaged, and so they were closed for a number of years, and so happened in 2001, they were reopening them. And they wanted an artist to also be part of the opening festivities. And so the director approached me. And at the time, I was coming back from Australia, and I was researching a lot about the history of music and war, and the whole notion of song and instruments connected to war. And in my research, I came across a book called War in the City of Dreams, The History of Corruption in the LAPD. And I was completely enthralled, you know. and it interestingly stopped. It traced the whole history of LAPD and its corruption, and it ends pretty much right at, during the whole Rodney King incident. And it lays it out pretty
and
clearly.
For those listening and not familiar, I think the Los Angeles Police Department has quite possibly the worst reputation of any police department in the United States, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And. Yeah. And it continues to be pretty seedy, you know. And so my original proposal to the director of the Watts Towers was to do a piece that had to do with music, being that I would be opening this big festival. It's also part of the Watts Drum Festival, so there's a lot of music going on. And I thought, well, the gallery shouldn't be this silent place. It should have music accompanied to it, and it should have something that's a little bit more interactive. And then I thought to myself, well, why am I going to do this history or this kind of work that deals with the historical notion of war when essentially there's a real war happening in our own streets in Los Angeles? And one of the first works that I proposed to the director was this kind of hip-hop stop-motion dance between these two young teenage boys, one dressed all in blue, which represents the Crips, it's a gang in Los Angeles, and the other all dressed in red, representing the Bloods. And so one is in blue Nike and the other is in red FUBU. And they're hip-hop dancing towards one another, almost like in this stop-motion freeze frame. And in the middle of the picture plane, they come together in this kiss. And prior to that, I'd been doing works, kind of bridging together histories and societies that don't see eye to eye and coming together in this kind of queer embrace or this kiss. And I thought to myself, you know, I maybe to do this work about gangs coming together or uniting in kind of this homoerotic way. Then I thought to myself, well, who are really the adversaries of disenfranchised youth? Who polices them? You know, and immediately I thought of law enforcement.
Yes.
And the very first painting that I did was a work called Spider and Officer Johnson, and that's the work that's here in San Francisco.
Right.
And it depicts a very large African-American male, and he's got this wonderful tattoo on his neck that means 187, which stands for murder in prison lore. And then he's got a spider web on his elbow, and he's reaching out. He just has his hands kind of extended out, and opposite to him is this police officer, blonde, Caucasian. And he's in the pose of like a 1970s disco kind of hustle. You know, when you, back in the day when you danced hand in hand and you twirled people.
Yes,
and
yes.
The way you came together was you kind of, you know, aimed towards each other's hands. And that was the beginning of this series called War, and that was the opening dance. And from then on, I started creating other works that depicted members of the sheriff department and from gangs that exist throughout Los Angeles, and also some gangs that no longer exist, because I grew up in East Los Angeles, and I have this whole history kind of connected to myself of having grown up as a kid and seeing gang tags all over the walls in neighborhoods. And some of these gangs kind of no longer exist. They get kind of taken over and they kind of fall into, you know, the wayside of history.
Appropriated by other gangs.
Yes. And I would have, for example, a gang member from a gang that is really old called Barrio Nuevo Estrada, and he's got a big a tattoo on his back that says VNE, and the Virgin of Guadalupe tattooed on his back, and he's dancing in this really sexually eroticized hip-hop way with an officer from the sheriff's department.
And so for those listening as well, as far as, you know, media and things like that, they're are they on plexi?
They're on plexiglass. Some of them are paintings also on canvas, but they're pretty much on a white background. There's no foreground or background to them. I've often thought of this body of work as representing a place that's akin to heaven, where there's no boundary, where there's no...
It's just a clear open field,
yeah. And the plexiglass works make the paintings, or make the images actually float up against off the wall. And I also on this project collaborated with a pretty renowned African-American poet, Keith Antar Mason, and he wrote a wonderful work called I Am a Lover of Concrete. And we silkscreened the text on the bottom of the floor in this really shiny kind of disco pattern. And so it made reference to kind of the shiny quality of disco and disco balls, because it was very reflective. And then I worked with a sound artist, Morgan Barnard, who's now in New York, and we created this soundscape that mixed everything from the Miranda Rights, kind of like a really camp version of the Miranda Rights, and we used actors kind of sounding off towards one another. We worked also with some historic sound recordings that we borrowed from, I think it was Pacifica Radio, that had to do with ex-LAPD officers, ex-LAPD officers being interviewed about the corruption in Los Angeles. And all of these texts were interwoven with famous disco songs like, Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive, to Donna Summer. Donna Summer's Love to Love You Baby. And that ongoing beat of just that kind of disco rhythm to all of these texts that are, highly politicized and campy also. Because essentially, when we were installing the work, the first week the paintings came up, people that would come in because the gallery is very much a community art center, although it's a very beautiful gallery, a lot of people from the community come in and take a look at what's going up, and people, I would watch people come in,
yes,
and they'd laugh, and then they'd move on to another painting, and then they'd continue to laugh, and then they'd laugh even more, and then they'd sit down and they'd read the catalog, and it was just this real kind of eye-opening experience in terms of how people were understanding the humor behind this work. Yeah.
Myself haven't seen something that laughed like hell. Right? But I can imagine that not everyone was happy with these pieces.
Not at all.
Probably high on the list for law enforcement's choice of month. What were some of the varied reactions that you had?
Well, unfortunately, when we were installing the exhibit, we were installing the first week of the month. And at the first week of the month, there's this kind of community action council, the Watts Community Action Council, that meets. And it's a group of elderly, conservative African-Americans that meet and use the gallery space to discuss what they're going to be doing for the Watts Festival. And being that this was the inauguration of the reopening of the towers, they were, pretty interested in using that space as a meeting space. And when they came in, they saw the paintings without any of the text or any of the soundscape.
It wasn't fully installed yet?
No, it hadn't been fully installed. And they started to just, scream bloody murder. They called the paintings pornographic.
Pornographic?
Yeah, they never...
Not bad, you got the big D. Good job.
That they would incite violence, that it would be an embarrassment in terms of all of the kind of big city officials that were going to be coming to the opening. Even Al Gore showed up to the opening, and some Italian representatives, being that Simon Rodia was Italian, they were going to be flying in some kind of dignitaries from Italy. And for them to see all of this, and also Bernard Parks had just been elected the new police chief, and he was going to be present at the big opening festivities. And so that's when the art center started, becoming bombarded by people, officials, city groups, we were about 3 days away from the opening of the exhibition, and invitations had gone out. People were emailing me that, oh yeah, we're gonna arrive, and I get called in to the big offices of the Cultural Affairs Department downtown in Los Angeles, and the newly elected Director of Cultural Affairs was Margie Reese, and she essentially told me, I'm falling on my sword, I've taken your show down. It wasn't a discussion, it wasn't like, let's talk about removing your works. The works are down, they are no longer up. And I said, you mean the gallery's empty right now? They said, yeah, your paintings are in storage. All that's left is this text along the edge of the bottom of the floor. And so here I kind of launch into this panic, because I'm expecting, a sizable crowd showing up. And sure enough, the director of the space, Mark Greenfield, he set up chairs in the middle of the gallery, and he knew he was going to have a discussion with the people who had were showing up. People came in, they thought I'd become like a minimalist artist, with just white walls.
And just some
Small text. And on each wall.
Oh, I love his new work.
Yeah.
It's amazing. so much more suggestive than his old work.
Yeah, he's making us read. And fortunately, I was at the time, I was an artist in residence at the Santa Monica art space called 18th Street Art Center. And Tim Miller was in residence there, and several other artists who were really familiar with Tim Miller being one of the big NEA artists who got their grants removed back in the day when the NEA took back all this money from, I think, artists like Holly Hughes himself. And so he was one of the big NEA four. So he put me in contact with the National Coalition Against Censorship. And it's an organization based in New York. And when they found this out, man, they sent out their press releases. And in a matter of a day, I was on the cover of the LA Times, you know.
There you go.
And I had the AFL-CIO on my side with their attorneys wanting to essentially sue the city for civil rights kind of infractions, and which they were. And at the time, also, the director of the art space had had it. He said this was a huge embarrassment to him in terms of being kind of called out as a curator, because he really believed in the work and still does stand aside, and he resigned. And so I started to see the whole infrastructure of the space kind of crumbling. The Watts Festival had already happened. They put up some photographs of just kind of like old pictures of the towers. And I decided, heck, I'm going to pamphlet the place. I'm going to go and just give flyers and have people sign a petition about what's going on with the city. And I got a great drag queen friend of mine to show up in her full kind of regalia drag and started handing out flyers. She even handed a flyer to Al Gore.
Not bad.
And people started realizing, oh my God, you know, underneath this whole festival here, because of the actions of these very conservative people in Watts that never really wanted to discuss the notion of sexuality and the kind of why it was they were really bothered by the images.
Right.
There was no discussion kind of laid out.
There was just acceptable,
yes,
unacceptable.
Exactly.
And you were deemed unacceptable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what do you think they were afraid of? I mean, is it homosexuality that they were afraid of? Was it kind of that class barrier?
I think
the law enforcement versus criminal that's so holy to them? Is it a combo punch?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things and more, because having sat through that whole discussion and remembering in terms of understanding that kind of roundtable discussion we had and the all the members of my community, in terms of people that were supporting my work, members from the Watts community that knew that what had happened, members of local media, and several gay African-American artists also started talking about, you know, that this is something that never really gets discussed in terms of certain generations of African-Americans. How does the black gay male figure, you know, sit in with the community? You know, it's something that just doesn't get discussed at all. It's incredibly closeted. It's akin to the Latino community and how their tolerance of homosexuality kind of exists. And it really put me in my place. As much as I wanted this exhibit to kind of seem and feel about this notion of forgiveness, they weren't having it. You know, seeing two men dance together erotically meant one thing and one thing only.
Right.
And it was something that they just didn't want to be kind of pinned up against the wall and called on. And I realized that certain people have a lot of power in the city, especially when you're working in nonprofit organizations. You know, they can silence you pretty swiftly. And also, unfortunately, the show coincided with September 11th, and people were coming in and seeing the exhibition, and because for about 4 days the show was up in its totality, and visitors were coming in, early visitors to see the opening of the towers as well, and they'd mingle into the gallery, and they had to put out new books to sign comments because they were just filling them. You know, we had published a little catalog and it had completely sold out. I remember one of the days I came in to photograph the space, it was a Sunday, and two LAPD officers had come in, and I immediately grabbed a broom because I thought, I'm going to pretend to be the cleaning guy, you know? And when they asked me, I said, oh, I don't know who the artist is.
Oh, I don't know. He's great, though, isn't he?
Yo no hablo inglés. And they were walking around.
What did they say?
Well, I watched them and observed them, and they started laughing. And then they came up to me and they said, "Where can we get another one of these catalogs?" And then I just gave them to them for free. And they said, "You know, this should be up at the Academy." And then I said, "What Academy?" They said, "The Police Academy. The young rookies should see this show, you know." And then they walked out and they were like, this is great. But then there was the extreme when I took my drag queen friend, the big opening of the evening, to hand out leaflets. There were, you know, the LAPD was out in droves, you know, protecting the neighborhood and making sure everything went smoothly. And when they saw the flyer, one of them literally took the flyer, crumbled it up and threw it at my feet and said, "You're the artist." And he just turned his back away from me. And he just, you know, you got a sense that there were kind of these real extreme ideas of again acceptance to this work, you know, that it really kind of touched a nerve in terms of the relationships that law enforcement officers have when it comes to a particular community. And it's a very different relationship than how Santa Monica police treat and serve the community of Santa Monica, as opposed to those officers that have to patrol and police neighborhoods like Watts or Compton, that are really tough neighborhoods, you know. And I touched a nerve. And it's interesting now that these works now have a much broader life. I mean, here we are about 7 years later, and these works continue to, you know, get called out and be brought into all sorts of exhibitions in terms of the context of criminal justice, censorship in America. One of them, which I loved, I was brought into an exhibit called The Color of God. And it was an exhibit about this contemporary notion of forgiveness, or these ideas of utopia. And I thought, wow, this curator really got it in terms of where I'm coming from in trying to create a landscape or a space that is unlike the world that we live in. And to create these possibilities really only exist in visual format, because you can invent these fictions. You know? And that keeps me sane, you know.
Now, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your history growing up in Los Angeles. And specifically, you know, kind of the impetus behind these specific paintings. Mm-hmm. Being, you know, were you living in L.A. during the Rodney King riots?
Oh, that's an interesting story.
If you were, then tell.
Yeah, in the 90s, like right at that time, my studio was burned down. I was, my very first studio was in Compton. And it was a little storage shed that I converted into a studio, and that whole row got toasted, and a lot of my early paintings don't exist, or they exist in a very singed because paintings do catch fire.
Yes, quite,
you know,
quickly.
Yeah. And on that the eve of the whole insurrection, I was moving all of my supplies to a new space exactly on the corner of Beverly and Western, which is Koreatown. And I drove through Beverly and seeing all of these shopkeepers with guns and rifles all along the rooftops. And I was moving into a new studio that was above a bank. And there I was fumbling with the key. And I'm on the bank, and three police cars come, like, literally right on that corner. And they shed their lights. They say, "Put your hands up, sir." And then they go through my car and they see all of these ratty brushes and stuff. And I said, "I'm moving in." And they're like, "What is all this stuff?" And then I said, "Well, you know, I paint." And then one of the officers, she was a female officer, she says, "Oh, you're an artiste?" And I said, "I'm an artist."
It's pronounced artist.
So you're an artiste? And, you know, I was there with my hands up with the lights. But, you know, I'd experienced that in Los Angeles. I mean, growing up in East Los Angeles, seeing helicopters hovering over your neighborhood, young kids running away from police officers, gang fights, worrying if my own brother was going to get involved in a gang. And when you grow up that way, you kind of, and if, you know, you're already kind of on the femme side of things, you kind of grow up the good boy. You know, you go to school and you try to do good grades, and you know, because you see all of this going around you, and you see the attitude that your parents have and the fear that they have also in terms of growing up in a tough neighborhood, and seeing your friends as well, kind of, you know, I had a lot of young friends, girls that got pregnant really, really young, and a lot of kids that never finished even middle school, you know, they dropped out and turned towards gangs. You know, you adopt and you adapt, and interestingly enough, at least for myself, a lot of those memories kind of still stay with me in terms of understanding what life is like to live in a city, and to have that vibrancy and that excitement also of understanding young groups of kids who don't want to follow the norm, you know, who want to be outside the mainstream, you know, and a lot of this comes from... you know, one of my research projects was understanding the history of gangs in Los Angeles, and a lot of it came from the lack of funding from parks and recreations, you know, right. After school programs, right. You know.
Something to actually, you know,
yeah.
Have kids occupy.
Yeah, so they would just, kids would gather around in the 50s and not do much of anything, you know, and they gathered around in parks, you know, and they started kind of forming turfs and kind of neighborhoods started developing these rivalries with other kids that defended these kind of open fields that later became City Terrace or Estrada Courts, these neighborhoods that are considered the projects. Prior to that were you know, low-income housing. They weren't
working-class
neighborhoods. Yeah, surrounded around a school. But then these pockets of neighborhoods, the funding was kind of cut from them in terms of after-school programs. And what do kids do when they have a lot of time on them, you know?
Yeah. Let's stir some shit up.
Yeah.
Now, yourself living in Los Angeles now, uh-huh. And... I go there occasionally, but I don't really have an insider's perspective because I don't live there.
Yeah.
Have you noticed much of a difference, not only in the LAPD, but also in kind of social dynamics since the riots? You know, it's you know, almost 20 years later,
mm-hmm.
Or is it past 20 years? You know, it's getting on.
Yeah, it's getting close, yeah.
Have you noticed much of a change in Los Angeles?
Yes, I feel that the police department is just... become, especially in Los Angeles, it's different in other communities, but in Los Angeles, LAPD, it's just a real frightening feeling more so. It seems a little bit more akin to what you might consider Gestapo, or how societies feel with a kind of secret society. Whereas previously, I remember officers coming into neighborhoods and just walking around and understanding a little bit more about the neighborhood.
Like beat cops.
Yeah, beat cops. That doesn't exist a whole lot anymore. You just see them fly by in the big shiny cars and pray to God they're not coming up behind you, you know?
The tinted black SUV.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, and it was, you know, in terms of like seeing what happened recently with the MacArthur Park incident. I mean, I have friends in the media that were incredibly shocked in terms of how the media was treated by the police officers essentially beating them back, you know, when people were demonstrating during the Cinco de Mayo demonstration in MacArthur Park, and they were, you know, in their right, you know, people had the right to peacefully demonstrate, and look what the hell happened, you know, that insanity of those officers just beating back all of those reporters. That, you know, that says a lot in terms of your attitude. You kind of like, when you see them walk on the sidewalk, you kind of like, you know, walk around
across
them.
Yeah.
And I think it still goes back to that the officers don't live in the neighborhoods that they police and that they patrol and that they care for. They live somewhere else.
That would change?
Oh yeah, it would really change. I mean, to have a police officer actually from a neighborhood, a tough neighborhood, they'd understand the dynamic. They'd understand the socioeconomic kind of situation of people. You know, people that are working class or kind of below working class in terms of economic situation, and instead of kind of coming in from far away, from, let's say, if you're living in Riverside or Orange County and you're patrolling or your beat is South Central Los Angeles, that's a whole a mindset, a world apart, you know? So I think that would be really important to create housing and to create jobs that kind of bring those communities of law enforcement and also fire departments and those kind of civil servants to kind of live within the communities that they serve, you know. You know, and to really uphold that idea of what's the LAPD's slogan? It's something like to protect and serve. Well, you know, hello, you know.
Well, thank you so much, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is Art Radio, WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You're listening at www.wps1.org, or perhaps you're also listening to frankprattle.com. Today, my extra special guest has been Alex Donis, who's a visual artist living in Los Angeles and showing internationally. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you, Zephyr.